You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Hey everyone, Yas here, and I just wanted to say it's great to have you join me today because I'm sure we're going to have another fantastic episode. So whether you're here for the first time or if you're one of the repeat loyal listeners of the show, I truly appreciate you. But before we get to today's guest, I just have a small favor to ask, and that's if you could just take a brief moment to hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Ensure that you share it with all your coaching friends, and don't forget to get in touch, guys. Let me know your thoughts on what you think of today's episode or any of the recent episodes you've listened to. You can do this on Twitter at The Coaches Net. Once again, that's at The Coaches Net. And please make sure you do, as I'd love to hear your thoughts, guys. Anyway, on to today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great day, guys.
The Coaches Network.
Hey, guys. You're now listening to The Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy. Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name's Coach Yas, and I've got a very special guest with me today. My guest today is Steve Whelan. Good afternoon, Steve. How's it going, man?
Good afternoon, Yas. I'm really good, mate. It's good to finally speak to you, and I'm excited to talk all things coaching.
Likewise. Steve, just for those that maybe aren't familiar with yourself, but maybe a brief background on who you are, what you do, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, cool. I think, first and foremost, I'm a tennis coach. I've been a tennis coach for 24 years. I know I look 24, mate. But yeah, I've been coaching a long time, straight out of school. Coached all different ages and stages, from beginners to national level juniors, ladies mornings, parks, schools, you name it, mate. I've probably coached it at some point. But a big bulk of my coaching was in probably what we call in tennis the talent development stages. So from 6 to 14, competitive players. In tennis, we call it performance. I don't like using that word. I'm sure we'll get onto some of that stuff. But it's mainly in that space, the talent attraction, talent development. I've been lucky because a few players have obviously gone on to international tennis and Grand Slam tennis. I don't take any credit for that whatsoever. But mainly in that competitive space, that's sort of my bread and butter, my day-to-day. I'm also in coach development. And there's a few different areas of in coach development that I sort of work in. I work with coach education. So I'm a coach tutor for the LTA, which is a national governing body here in the UK. So I deliver coach qualifications and sort of CPD. So I help coaches get through their qualifications and obviously keep their licensing or accreditation. Second part of that is coach development. So I see those two things as separate. So coach development is independent of qualifications and a national governing body. And that's sort of delivered in coaching workshops, coach mentoring, more bespoke sort of coach support, really, is, I think, is a good way to describe it. And I guess the third and sort of final part of my day-to-day work is I talk a lot about coaching methodology. So over the past 24 years, I've probably used most coaching methodology methods available in tennis, especially. So starting off with information processing, cognitive psychology, games for understanding, game-based coaching, and more recently sort of ecological dynamics, ecological psychology. And of course, the big buzzword at the moment is constraint-led approach. So I present on those topics at coach conferences. I talk to people like your good self on podcasts about coaching methodology. And for my sins, I put content out on social media and I get involved in long debates on LinkedIn on what is good coaching and what is maybe not effective coaching. So it's a pretty busy week, mate, but I love it. It's coaching. I love working with players. I love working with coaches. I love challenging myself and trying to find a better way to ultimately make my players better. But yeah, that's sort of me in a very short period of time over 24 years.
I love that. It's awesome. Again, you've kind of got, you know, my mind blown in which way to take this, because there's so many different things you've touched on there already that are really, you know, useful things and insightful things to kind of unpack. So I'm gonna start with this one. You know, you touched on it at the beginning straight away. 24 years of experience now. Just talk to that a little bit, because you know, I think there's a big shift in terms of just coach education in the first instance, but also what coach development looks like. And I guess it is still relatively in its infancy as an industry of coach development. I think something that a lot of people are really taking heed on now, in just how important it is. And let's start with that. And your experience, you know, you said you worked you've been coaching for 24 years. Just how important is it just to get that depth and range of experience? Because you're talking about so many different ages and stages that you've kind of embarked upon. And, you know, just to give some context as well, obviously, you know, my sport is football. Your sport is obviously tennis. And, you know, it's interesting having a conversation with a colleague of mine earlier today and just talking about, you know, where does the passion come from? And ultimately, I put it back down to, well, it's effectively just people development and using the sport of football in my case, and maybe tennis in yours, as a vehicle to do that. So maybe just speak to that a little bit, and we can go from there.
Yeah, to be honest, I think I've been quite fortunate because I've worked in so many different areas of coaching, whether that be coach education or being a coach myself. I'm working with lots of different levels and ages and stages of players. It gives you a wider range of coaching skills to connect with different people. And I'm sure we'll get on to coach development, but like one of the issues I have with coach development is everyone starts at the same point on day one, and you're meant to get them to the end point on day five or six, whatever your coach qualification is. But every player I come into contact with is unique and different. They've got different life experiences. They've got different goals. They've got different skills. And I think because I've worked in such lots of different spaces, I'm pretty good at just meeting people where they're at. Okay, well, where do you want to go? I'm like, how can I help you get there? And that's no matter what your goal is. If your goal is to play Wimbledon, great. I'll try my best. It's not going to be easy. But if your goal is just to play at your ninth ladies team at the club, well, that's still a goal. And you have different wants and needs. And one of the biggest maybe criticism I've got of coaches is coaching is not copy and paste. And that's something that I learned early on in my coach development was I can't do the same lesson with an under eight squad that I can with under 12. Different experiences, different skill sets, different goals. So I became very adaptable early on. I sort of went against the grain. And again, if you ever see my social media, I'm not bothered about going against the status quo. But you have to be. You literally have to adapt to what's in front of you. And I think when I first started coaching, one of the best advice I got as a young coach was coach everyone, coach as many different sessions as you can. Go and make loads of mistakes as a coach. Like, don't feel you have to deliver the best possible session, because that best possible session never exists. And that really stuck with me. And it was a case of just going out there and putting myself in really awkward situations. Like, one of my first ever sessions, mate, was with a mixed disability group. I had no experience in coaching, no idea what to do. But it was one of the best experiences of my life, because rather than going in with a plan, I literally said to them, what do you enjoy doing? And they just told me, okay, well let's just do that then. And that sort of stuck with me. So hopefully that answers your question. It's just, for me, it's just been adadaptable. And you touched upon that. It's about connecting with people. It's not so much delivering a drill or a game. It's the people in front of you.
Again, it's quite interesting. You touched on a few things there, and it got me thinking already, you know, meeting people where they're at. And I think that's the biggest challenge, isn't it? It's having the empathy to understand that, you know, everyone is at a different starting point, or even whatever point they're at. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And I think whilst there might be many principles to it, in terms of the sport that you're working in, and I guess some of the key things that have been done traditionally, I really love them. And I think it's really what kind of attracted me to a bit of your content as well. You know, I'm quite the same. I do like to challenge the norm and be somewhat provocative at times. But I think it's good. It's good. I think you need people that are willing to challenge those norms, because it's through those challenges, you know, we're either going to confirm that things are really good, things that are taking place, are being taken place in a really good aspect. Or actually, maybe there's some change that needs taking place as well. And I think, you know, one of the things that you certainly got me thinking about when you were just speaking there is making mistakes is obviously key. And you said, you know, no session is perfect. I think you know, the underlying message that I've taken away from what you just said then is kind of made me think, well, session could be perfect, but what's perfect for me isn't perfect for you. And I think, you know, that appreciation for like what everyone wants from a session, or what everyone wants from the experience of being involved in that interaction, is fundamentally different. And, you know, you kind of touched on it there in terms of asking them, what do they enjoy? And it's something I talk about a lot, in that the idea isn't to cut or constantly come up with new practices or new drills, as people would call them, or whatever it might be. But the idea and the challenge should really be, well, can you find a vehicle within the context of what you're working in that it just engages those people? And I talk about it a lot in that relevance drives engagement. Now, if you start putting on a practice for me that you think it might be useful for me, but I don't see the relevance of it, I'm not going to be engaged in it regardless. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but it just really got me thinking about a few different things based on what you said so far.
Yeah, it's massive. That sort of that co-design is that's the art of coaching. Because, and I say this a lot in stuff that I talk about, I'm not the star of the show. So when you come to a lesson with me, whether it be a private lesson or a group session, like a team session, I'm not the star. It's not about me and what I want and stuff that I want to go after. It's about, okay, what do you need? What do you want? And sometimes need and wants are two separate things. Okay, well, then how can we design this practice to get the most out of it? And it's a little bit different, because a lot of coaches feel that they should be the authority figure. They've got the experience, they've got the qualifications, they should be leading the session. They should give the solutions. Whereas I see it differently. I see it from a case of, well, you've got your goals. You either want to get to this level or play in this team or whatever it may be. Okay, well, what do you need and want to get there? So let's start with that. And then my job is, okay, I'm going to create loads of problems for you. I'll create the problems. You then find the solutions. And that, again, that gets a little bit lost in context, because people say, well, you just set up games and you just stand back. Well, not quite. I'll watch how you interact and how you engage with that practice. And then if we're not getting the desired outcome, I'll change it and I'll tweak it. But I won't stop it and tell you how to get the effect. And for me, it's that co-design. But also it's that idea of just exploring it together. Years ago, if you, again, tennis context, but if you would have said to me, oh, how can I fix my serve? I'll look at it and then I'll just give you some buzzwords.
Yeah.
No idea if that's actually going to work. Whereas now...
It's something interesting within that, though, isn't it, Steve? That it could well work. The buzzwords could well work, yeah. But that's not the solution for every individual. And, you know, something I always think about this one experience I had, and it was a game changer for me. And I remember about 6 or 7, probably a little bit more than that, maybe, but yeah, 7, 8 years ago now, working with a group of players, goalkeepers in particular, in this instance, and never worked with these players in particular, because we were going for a bit of a recruitment phase at the club I was working at, and we had 7 different goalkeepers. We had 2 that were born and bred and grew up in England, a couple others that were, you know, recently came to England in the last few years, from different backgrounds, and then we had another one that came over literally like maybe a few weeks before coming into the trial session, if you like. And in my head, linked to, you know, those buzzwords and that perfect technique, if you like. I had an idea of what it should look like for them. And then as the session was developing, like literally maybe 10 minutes in, I found myself in a real dilemma. And the dilemma was like, okay, they're getting success, but something isn't right here. And what I had to then contest with and accept in the end, once I've been able to identify it, was that they're all getting success, but none of it's done in the way that I want to see it done. Mm-hmm. And then it really started, you know, so I always say to people that I walked into that session with one way of being done and left with eight. But what it gave me is more questions and gave me more curiosity. Well, why does Steve do it this way? Why does, you know, John do it that way and Tyreek do it that way and so on and so forth? And it really just started to change my whole perception of, right, well, what is coaching? Coaching isn't mean, you know, part of it might be me instructing you with some clear guidance on things. But actually, it's about, like you said, we're going to go on that journey together, the exploration, right? And the analogy I use is like the role of the coach is the same with a coach developer to a coach, right? In that we're going to go on this journey together, but the destination needs to be one that's set by you.
Mm.
And there's going to be times where I'm going to be in the driving seat and you're just going to be in the passenger seat driving along. Vice versa, there's going to be other times where I've given you the keys to drive and I'm just going to sit here and just observe the journey on its way. And other times where I can recognize that, you know what, you've broken down, so I'm going to give you a push from behind. And, you know, it's using that as a way to understand it's not always about what you can offer, but sometimes what you can pull out. So there's that push and pull kind of approach to it. And then, you know, something you touched on there was around effectively designing problems. But then, you know, it got me thinking, so is the role of the coach really to be a problem designer or a problem provider? Because actually the designing aspect of it should really be linked to what's already out there in the context of the game that they're playing, right? And you're just maybe bringing their awareness to that. So, you know, I guess the first question will be that. And then something that I found, my mind just works in, you know, different ways. And I just start thinking about all sorts of stuff. But you mentioned tennis lesson. And it got me thinking straight away, hey, why don't we ever call it a lesson in football? Why is it a lesson and not a session? Vice versa, why is it a session, not a lesson? And again, maybe it's just my play on words sometimes, and I think to myself, this, I the way my mind works, I have to find meaning in everything.
Great, I love it. I think there's loads to unpack there. I think the first one in terms of problem setter or problem solver, was it?
Problem designer or problem provider.
I think for me, I always look at the context of the game. So everything starts with the game at tennis, which is different to most tennis coaches. Because most tennis coaches, the perception is we teach you how to hit the shots first and then we put it into a game later on. Classic fundamentals argument, massive in tennis. Whereas I look at it, no. We'll start with a game because tennis is a really simple game. All I've got to do is put the ball into a position that makes you miss. It's not to hit the ball to you. I've got to put the ball in a position where you miss. So let's just start with that. So let's start with that. And if I see you can't do that, okay, that's going to give us stuff to work on. So a classic example, if you're serving and you're just getting the ball in and I can easily get it back, we've got to make your serve more effective. So that's now I've got a problem. Your serve is too easy to return. Can I design a practice where you now start to explore some space? So, okay, let's make the space big. So can you serve and tram lines are in? So now you've got a bigger space. Can you explore that space? So I'll always go back and start with the context of the game. And then I'll look at, okay, how you then interacting with it and what behaviors can we shape to make you more efficient and effective? And mm-hmm. That's a little bit different to how a lot of tennis coaches work. A lot of tennis coaches will look at your forehand technique, your backhand technique, your service technique, and they'll give you the shapes and then try and put it into a game later on. But then there's a big disconnect because context has changed. So when I sort of set problems, it's always relates to how is this going to make you win more points? Because that's what tennis is. Tennis is not rallying. Tennis is winning points. And that's sometimes sort of trying to defend and not lose points. And for me, it always starts there. So that's the first question I sort of go with. How is this going to impact the game? Okay, and what problems can I set you to guide you, bring your attention and intention towards a more efficient and effective way.
And just something you touched on then, you mentioned that it's a tennis thing that you do, it's fundamentals. Actually, I think it's quite common, isn't it? And it links back to something you said earlier on. what coaches may perceive their role to be and how they envisage that to look. And I think, you know, it's a conversation I'm having with a lot of coaches and coach developers at the moment around, well, we're probably know where it comes from, because it's probably historical references and perceptions around what coaching looks like. It's probably something that the coach now has probably previously experienced as a player, mm-hmm. or they've worked alongside a experienced coach, whatever that means, and that's how it's been done. And it reminds me of another experience. It's one that will stay with me. It's like, I remember working with a group of players, and they were maybe 4 to 8 year olds, set up a session. And this session, just for context, was a session that was set up for female players, 4 to 8, basically never kicked a ball. And players are enjoying it. You can visibly see these players are getting better because of the experiences they're getting. But about 6 months in, one of the parents approaches me and says, you know, the players are loving the sessions. Like, we can see they're getting better, but when are you going to start coaching? And I found it incredible. I was like, okay, cool, interesting. Like, you know, it just really made me think that we really have to kind of challenge those norms, like you said, and around the perceptions of what coaching is, what coaching looks like, and how it should be, I guess, enacted, because it is different for every single individual come into contact with. Like, and even linked to that is challenging the perception of the players themselves, the athletes themselves, around what effective coaching is. Because one of the things that sometimes, you know, experience, I'm sure you've come across this before as well, where a player might tell you, well, I need you just to tell me what to do, or I need you to do this, or because they think that's how they learn, or they think that's what's most effective. And it could well be the case. But the question I'm always asking myself when they bring stuff like that, how do you know that? Like, is it really how you best learn, or is it actually that's where you've had your most positive experiences? And it's not so much about the methodology that's been approached, but the experience mm-hmm. that you've had with it. Again, there's loads there. I'm not sure you can kind of pick onto, but it just got me thinking, like, we've really got to, again, challenge that norm and perception, break the barriers around what effective coaching actually looks like. And then it leads me on to another question, which I've started asking a lot of coaches and even coach developers. How do you know that you're doing it well? Yeah. How do you know it's your impact or your influence that's actually making that difference and not something else?
That's a good, powerful question, which I'll come on to in a few seconds. I think what you said there about the perception of coaching, for me, it's the expectation. Like, I had a call this morning with a group of coaches from around the world, and the expectation of a beginner when they walk on is they're going to walk on and play like Federer and Nadal. And that's the coach's job, right? To get them from this beginner to Nadal, which is completely nuts. But my sort of way of thinking is, a bit like we said before, you have to meet them where they're at. Like, if I walk on and I'm a beginner, that's my level. So rather than future-proofing me and trying to make me play like I should do in 10 years' time, just make me better today. Just make me better with what I got today. Rather than having this picture in your head of what good looks like. And I think, again, from a football point of view, and I've seen it with my two daughters who play football. I'm a big football fan. My background is actually football. But like, when I see them train, they're spending so long dribbling around cones. And I'm like, that's not useful. But again, that's the perception of what coaching is, and it's technical. From a tennis point of view, when a player walks on, that's really good for what they have. And if I'm a beginner, I don't need to serve like Federer, because I'm playing at a level where my opponents play the same way. So all I've got to do is beat another beginner, and I can do that in quite easy ways. But in tennis, and I see it in football as well, like, we try and get these kids to play like professional player. These are professional athletes who train 3-4 hours a day, and they've been doing it for 20, 30 years. You're a 7-year-old kid who plays once a week.
Like, you know, it's so important, and it just sparked my memory on a recent conversation I had with a colleague of mine, and he, when you think about it, yeah, it's logical, but, you know, it's a point that I didn't consider in the way that he articulated it more than anything, was that if I use football as an example, and I think tennis is always, because I used to play tennis when I was younger, and it's probably quite similar to how it is now as well, in that it's not something that you can go down and you can just play on the street necessarily. It is, but it's not something that commonly happens, if you like. So it is usually in an organised setting of some sort. But the point that he was making is that, you know, there's this massive shift towards more a game-based approach and, you know, context and all that type of stuff, which I think is brilliant and it's a great opportunity. But then it got me thinking deeper around the idea that actually maybe historically, whether consciously or not, coaches went down the more technical route with coaching because actually, especially in football, there always has been an element of free play away from an organised environment. Mm-hmm. You would go out and play on the streets. You would go out and play in the park or whatever that might look like. And obviously society's changed and things have to change with that, to the point where actually maybe back then or in previous times, it probably was beneficial for them to get a lot of support around refinery of techniques and whatnot. Whereas now, where especially in football, where that's not the case anymore, there's not as much free play, there's not as much emphasis on just being able, you know, being able to go and just have a kick about, if you like.
Yeah.
Actually, maybe that's where the focus should need to be, because now, when the balance is, well, they're not getting play that needs to be refined; they're just not getting play.
It's a huge social cultural shift, isn't it? Like even like I learned how to play tennis on the street, by the way, and on a hill. Like you try playing tennis on a hill, mate. If you're going downhill, you've got a good advantage. But like kids don't play no more. So everything again, no matter what sport it is, it's all structured. And the problem is there's expectation from parents on that as well. So if I'm taking you to a football session, I expect to see coaching, and then parents will then relate to education. So what does education look like? There's an authority figure. They should know what they're doing. Lots of instructions, lots of discipline, and you're showing them how to build the skills. But we know as experienced coaches, and you mentioned it there, it's not the most effective way humans learn. And I say it a lot to parents and coaches, you will learn more from playing tennis by playing a match than you will having 10 lessons of me. And I've had conversations with parents, and I remember one parent in particular, they wanted 5 private lessons a week with me. And it's good money for me. Like, it's easy money. And I'm like, no. And I'm like, why? Because one, it's the most fake environment in the world. Like, it's just ridiculous. And two, you don't need it. You need a lesson. And that's where you need coaching, because coaching brings your attention and makes you play with intention. That's what coaches do really well. But you need to then go and apply it in context. And there's nothing better than actually playing the game. And within tennis, and I don't know what's like in football coaching now, but kids will have lots and lots of coaching and there's no matches. Like it's very normal for kids to have, I don't know, 12 weeks of lessons and not play a single tennis match.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why are you having lessons?
Yeah, 100%.
It makes no sense to me.
100%. You know, it's something quite interesting as you were speaking at that. So I'm about 18 months ago, I started doing jiu-jitsu.
Nice.
And it's incredible, like, experience. And I guess with a coaching lens on it, I'm constantly observing, right, how do they do things? What's their approach? And it is something that I've actually picked up and adopted. And picked up and adopted, but also it's, I guess, adapted from what I was already doing. And the fact that, you know, we've got this unopposed kind of, right, let's just work on that technique and that, you know, the mechanical aspect of things. And then, like you said, you've got the context of actually playing in a game, match, whatever. But generally speaking, what happens when you go to jiu-jitsu, right? We'll do a little bit it can't be unopposed in the first instance. It's, and you know, if you've got opponents, let's use them. But what they use a concept which is almost, right, it's semi-opposed and it's structured around specific positions. So if I was to relate that to the context of tennis or football, it would be right at a specific moment in the game. And that specific moment in the game is, you draw the specific moment rather than a technique attached to the moment.
Yeah.
Right. And through obviously just drilling the moment, you start to adapt the technique based on what the moment requires, which is something that, you know, I've been playing around with for a few years in the football context. And it does baffle me sometimes why it's not an approach that's widely considered as effective, because actually the reality is, you know, put them in the game, you said, you know, they can really learn a lot from the game. I think part of it's obviously the coach's role in terms of supporting them in the reflection and the awareness process of it.
Yeah.
So that attention piece that you talked about, but being aware of the moments in a way where they're game-like, to the point where when it comes up in a game, you're not surprised to see it. You're actually, this is exactly what training felt like, or this is what training looked like. And I challenge coaches, like, you know, can you truly say that your sessions are a simulation of what they're going to experience? So I use the analogy of Gran Turismo game. And I say, well, is it a racing game or is it a simulation? Well, it's a bit of both. Okay, fine. But ultimately, which one is it first? Well, it's a simulation. And the racing element comes from you understanding what car, you know, what track and all the other stuff around it, and what you might need to do. So like you might pick a particular car on this race and not on that track and so on and so forth. And it's the same thing in football, tennis, or all the other sports, right? It's going back to the point of, you know, is it problem designed or is it problem providing? Are you actually designing problems? Because there's probably no problems that you're going to design that don't already exist in the game, in context. And that's the key part as well, right? It's got to be in context. Otherwise, you're not practicing the game. You're practicing a version of it.
Yeah, and that's a huge point. And I think when I reflect on my early days of coaching, we believed in that style of coaching. If we decontextualize it, if we strip away variability, if we develop the skill in isolation and build up the fundamentals, then it becomes through the stages of learning, the cognitive psychology route, and then hopefully it will appear in the game. But you're right, because the information's not the same, the human behavior, not the player, the human behavior changes. And this is quite a lot or big in tennis. So the serve, arguably one of the most complicated shots, apparently, in world sport. I've got an argument against that. But the amount of times you see coaches practice the serve with no returner, and it's just an empty box, and they're working on the technique or the shape, but there's no information to use. So once you put a returner in that position, everything changes. Because now you've got someone looking at you dead in the eye. You've now got to work out, well, are they going towards their forehand or backhand? Which is their best shot? Then you add in the score. Okay, I'm going to serve differently 15-40 down and 40-15 up. And now I've got, like you said there, I've got lots of information that I'm trying to sort of work out of, okay, well, what do I now have to do? And it's a bit like you're saying with jiu-jitsu. Like, you can practice on a dummy all day long. Because I remember going to jiu-jitsu classes and they give me this dummy. I'm like, this is stupid, because when I try it on Yaz, he's going to literally just choke me out.
Yeah.
I'll try my armbar and then you'll just counter me, because it's live interaction and it doesn't transfer the way we think it is, going back to the serve. Like, once you put a returner there, everything changes.
And not just that, but I think it's a really good point that you make, because it's not just the returner being there. It's who is the returner? You know what I mean? Who is that? Because, you know, fundamentally, like you said, you know, I was training last night at jiu-jitsu, and I'm sparring with a couple of my mates there, and I'm thinking to myself, I know I can get away with doing this on you, but I wouldn't be able to do this on you. So I have to do something differently against you because of what you bring to the table, if you like, and the skill sets you got. And then I say to the same, like, for coaches in football, like, you can't teach one thing to everyone. But what you can do, and I think this is where I've kind of started building a piece of work around, is that there will be constants. There will be constants regardless of the situation. So as an example, you know, and I guess the easiest way to kind of explain it is, like, if you wanted to pass me a ball, there's no way you're going to pass me a ball in a logical fashion that wouldn't require you to play it in my direction. That's just the physics of the situation. Right, doesn't matter whether it's you, whether it's John, whether it's Billy, whoever it is, they have to play the ball in this direction to get it to me. So let's focus on using that as a basis to identify what are the facts of what we would need in this situation. Because the objective pieces are always going to be there.
Yeah.
But then the subjective piece is almost like, well, actually, Steve happens to be quicker than Jamie, so Steve can get away with doing this way. Or, you know, if you use, you know, someone like Kyle Walker as an example, Kyle Walker talks about sometimes not being as tight to players because, or even not even worrying about getting too tight to players, because he's not worried about the risk of having to then catch up with the player because he trusts his speed to get there.
Yeah.
As an example, that is literally a factor which will affect his performance and his actions and his behaviors, right? And it's the same thing. So, you know, going back to the experience I had with those 4 to 8 year old girls, a lot of my coaching with them was very much around helping them identify, right, what's the problem in front of you? And its scenario will stay the same, but the individuals in question will differ. So now yes, the scenario is the same, but it's now a different problem because actually you're not as quick as this person, or you are stronger than that person, or you're just as quick as this person, or just as strong as that person, or that person likes to use this foot more than this foot, and getting them to better analyze and I guess observe and identify and notice what those variables might be. Went on a bit of a tangent there, but hopefully there's
it's good though, because it's a common challenge across all coaching, isn't it? Like, oh, there's classic fundamentals on how to pass a football, so therefore there must be fundamental technique, same in tennis. But my argument is there's fundamental laws like gravity. So if I serve, gravity is going to pull the ball down. There's precisely fundamental physics. If I hit a ball on the side, it will slice. If I go back, it will go flat. If I go up, it will go top spin. They're fundamental laws of physics and gravity. So that's what fundamentals are. But then they're also fundamental sort of commonalities in the task. So if I want to hit a forehand cross court, I know I've got to make contact in front of the body. That's not a technical fundamental. That's a task fundamental.
Yes.
And that's where coaches get lost, because they think it's a body movement's fundamental. But how I achieve that is irrelevant. And again, tennis has got a great poster boy for this called Medvedev. Medvedev's forehand's all over the place, like an octopus.
Mm.
From a tennis traditional point of view, it looks ugly. Guy was world number one and Grand Slam winner. But the task doesn't change. The laws of, like you said, their physics don't change. That's the fundamental part of the situation. The bit that's harder is the variability around it. Because, like you said there, if I'm taking a penalty against the world's best goalkeeper, Jordan Pickford, probably guess what team I support now. There's a lot of mental pressure there on the striker, because Pickford's got a good penalty record. And he's quite intimidating with his face pulling and stuff. Or if you're taking a penalty against the Villa keeper, he's got a good reputation. If you take a penalty against, I'm trying to think of a really bad goalkeeper, like Alisson Becker, like he's a rubbish goalkeeper. Now you can tell what football team I support. It's different. If you take a penalty in front of the cop, it's different than taking it in front of the Gladys Street. It's those variables, they ultimately will decide human behavior. Mm. The technique is irrelevant. And I think that's why for years we've struggled in penalty shootouts as a national team, because you can practice those penalties all the time, mate. When it's a World Cup semi and you're taking that last kick,
different kind of fish.
Does not come down to technique. It comes down to behavior 100%. And how you behave in those moments. And I think that's the bit coaches miss. Like I mentioned before, and it was quite obvious what I said, but these are humans we're dealing with. They're not machines.
But you say it's obvious, and we quite often forget. That's the bit that we often forget. Yeah. You know, it's too obvious for us to remember, right? And it says, again, I think you're spot on, because I always, you know, when I challenge coaches around this stuff around technique and what, you know, whether we should even be bothered coaching it, I always lead them towards actually, well, coming back to the thing I said about problem design, problem five, like, actually, what about if you just set objectives? Just set them objectives, because, you know, I give them a scenario, like, you know, if you're Pep Guardiola, Erling Haaland scores 50 goals this season, like, good return. But what happens now if a day later the analyst comes up to Pep and says, "Yo, by the way, did you know he scored 50 with right kneecap? Well, still a good return, right?"
Yeah.
You ain't gonna, you know, chastise him because he's using his right kneecap. Now you might have some thoughts on whether he should be doing it that way or not, but the reality is the proof is in the pudding, it's working for him.
Yeah.
And he's found a way to do it that might be unconventional, but the bottom line is it doesn't really matter. He's got the objective done. And again, the more relatable one I give to people to think about is, well, at the end of the month, look, we're waiting for payday. I've never met anyone that asked their employer, where did the money come from?
Yeah.
do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it does ask a lot of questions for coaches, or give a lot of questions for coaches to think about. But, you know, something that, you know, I'm really interested to kind of explore, but you touched on it earlier. You were very specific in terms of differentiating the difference between coach development and coach education. Let's talk about that a little, because it, again, is it just a play on words, or is it not? Because I actually agree with you. You know, there's a fundamental difference, and maybe actually education is part of the role of the coach developer rather than coach development being part of the role of the educator, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's a common, I'll say common, it's an interesting discussion now that's going on across multiple different sports. Like, is it coach developer, coach tutor, coach educator? So I'll give sort of my opinion and spin on it. So as a coach educator, I've got to get you from day one to assessment. And I've got a set list of competencies. I've got the driving test at the end of the qualification. No matter where you are, experience-wise, playing background, how much coaching you've done is irrelevant. I've just got to get you from A to B. Yeah. And all I've got to do by that last day is make sure you can pass that exam. The challenge I have is, well, everyone comes from different levels of experience. Everyone coaches differently. Like, if I give an example, I'm sure you have this as well when you do your coach education. Like, on a level one, I could have an ex-player, a 16-year-old kid, a dad who's a plumber. But they all start in the same position, and they've all got to get to the same angle. So when I'm a coach educator, all I'm focused on is just that end assessment. And for me, it's a little bit fake because I've just got to get you to perform in front of an assessor. A bit like the driving test. And no matter what national governing body writes down the competencies, as long as you show those competencies on that assessment, you'll pass.
Yeah, to an extent, yeah. I mean, I could, it's a debate and discussion I'm having with a lot of coach developers at the moment. It's like, well, those competencies are still subjective.
Yeah, 100%.
Do you know what I mean? Whether, like, you know, there's been a massive shift in football recently around coach competencies and frameworks of what effective coaching or what successful looks like on each qualification. But fundamentally, look, if you've been doing what you've been doing for 24 years and you've been around certain experiences, you're going to be biased in your own way around what those competencies maybe could or should look like. So, you know, I think there is an argument for allowing coaches to express themselves in different ways and having that. But I think there is also that argument that, well, actually, you know, we need to see that you can do certain things.
Yeah.
And you know, those certain things, whether rightly or wrongly, do need to be objectively agreed.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
When I met, to deem yourself competent. But then I think, you know, there's got to be a middle ground which standardizes things. Otherwise, you'll have too many coaching courses for different specialisms, which we'll never see the end of.
Yeah,
because everyone is different. They all coach in different environments for different reasons. And, you know, it's something you talked about earlier around, you know, that performance individual versus talent. I know you didn't like using the word performance, but I think it is understanding that there's different environments that you're walking into. And I think, you know, one of the roles of the coach developer within that, or even the coach in this case working with players, is actually to open the mind of the individual that they're working with to understand actually there's more to what you're doing.
Yeah.
But also recognizing that, and I've had this as a coach with players in the past, where a player thinks they've hit their peak, but actually you as a coach, you know, my role and my responsibility as a coach, in my opinion, is to be able to identify, right, where can we unpack more potential?
Mm-hmm.
Where can we expose you to more? And it might be stuff that you've never considered, but part of it is also recognizing that, as an example, I can think about this one particular player. I was working with a university team at the time. Started here, they were doing a recruitment process to identify which players are going to end up in which squad and whatnot. And it was very political at one point. And I looked at one player and I'm like, this guy's decent. And then the first response I got, well, yeah, but he's a third team player. And okay, well, maybe he needs to, maybe some of the first teams need to drop to the third team then, right? But because he's got something, but it's, I guess, you know, part of the role of the coach, in my opinion, is to identify that potential and see the value in that person can bring. And sometimes it's the challenge I give to coaches is, can you expose that player to more than what they understood to be possible for them?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, people say, oh, yeah, but they're not interested in it, or they might not be a performance player, they might be just doing it for the social part. Yeah, but maybe they're limited to that because that's all they have, they could ever access.
Yeah.
But where can you take them to is the point. But then again, linking it back into the coach development role and the educator, like, and I agree with you to an extent that the educator is about getting you through a process,
yeah,
or giving you a set of information or insights that are going to help you with that process in terms of the qualification. But the developer part is just it goes way beyond that.
And that's the way I see it as well. So when I do my coach development, it's more bespoke, it's more personal. And it's interesting as well when you engage with coaches with different hats, because if I engage you as an educator, everything you say to me, you feel you're being judged because of an assessment, and you're always conscious of what you're saying. There's a very clear in your mind what's right and wrong, because there's a competency list at the end with X's and ticks on it. When I talk to you as a coach developer, as a mentor, mate, there's no right or wrong. And so therefore, not only do you see me completely, your perception of me is different, your conversations with me are completely different. And when I watch you coach as a coach educator, it's a show. It's a routine. You just show me what I need to see, so I tick the boxes.
Yeah.
When I watch you as a coach developer, it's more natural, it's real, and I'm not judging you, because there's no pass or fail. And those two different roles, what I found, coaches definitely engage more freely when I'm in a developer setting, and it's more natural. And it's a case of, and you had Russell Earnshaw on, who's amazing, by the way, but it's more like just asking really good questions, like, what did you see there? Because you may have seen something that I didn't see.
Mm.
And even from an educational point of view, you may have seen something that's really, really useful, but it goes against my tick box.
Mm.
Well, you've seen it, and it's really good. And a good example, I won't give away the national governing body, it's not my one, but a coach developer's doing an assessment, and the coach got the players to serve in the assessment, and on their assessment, they're not allowed to serve, and they failed. And the guy was going, hang on, but the serve starts the point. Yeah, but it's not on the assessment. And that's where the coach education part for me sometimes makes no sense. Because the coach is actually doing something that impacts the game. And that's where I think sometimes we get restricted. I agree that there has to be some type of level. Not everyone can be a coach. That there has to be core competencies. But that's where, like, if you listen to Stuart Armstrong, I know Stuart's been on your podcast as well, but like, he did a great sort of podcast series on the talent equation. Coach education is broken. But like, why aren't we just mentoring these coaches for education? Like, for me, you don't complete coaching.
Yeah.
Like,
it's an ongoing process. But
it's forever going. Like, I'm 24 years in. I'm probably learning more about coaching from other sports than I am tennis.
Yeah.
Because I'm engaged with people like yourself. But like, for me, so if there's no end goal, why do we have qualification levels? If there's no end goal, why can't we just have mentoring? Like,
yeah.
So like, rather than... Go on, mate.
I was just going to say, it's a real challenge, though, isn't it? Because the coach developers themselves, or coach educators, whichever capacity they're working in, as I mentioned earlier, they'll have their own biases and they'll have their own experience to bring to the forefront, right? And I think coach development in the mentoring aspect is a different skill.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I could have bags of knowledge, but I might not know how to effectively get it across to you, and vice versa, right? And it even fits. So I think, as you were speaking, it just made me think, okay, well, what's the number one thing that a coach developer needs to be good at? And I think it's just being curious.
Yeah.
Just being curious. And it's something that I say to coaches, it's the same for coaches to play, just be curious. Mm-hmm. Why are they doing it the way they're doing it?
Yeah.
And it's not to say that they're right, but I think part of that comes with knowledge, because you can only be curious about something you've got an idea about,
mm-hmm.
right? Because then the curiosity coupled with the knowledge that you've got will allow you to ask better questions to unpack that situation a little bit further. Whereas I think this is where the challenge comes, right? In terms of coach development, sometimes you've got coaches who may be less experienced, or coach developers who may be less experienced in not only developing people, but coaching themselves.
Yeah.
Or they've been influenced by different things, or they may be like, you know, I remember seeing, I think right now, I've been doing coach education for coming up, yeah, pretty much 10 years now. And if I look at the journey that I came through as a coach, I can visibly see the difference between how I work as a coach developer to someone who's maybe become a coach developer in the last 2 or 3 years and has maybe only been coaching for 6 or 7 years. Like, I could see that difference in that. I always consider myself quite fortunate in football, in particular, in the fact that I've come through in what might have been a very instructional method of coach development and coach education. And it was pretty much more, we had coach educators rather than coach developers, to the point where now it's at the back end of my formal qualification journey, if you like, in terms of football, I came through what was maybe a bit more of a coach development process, but I had a foundation to work from. And I always say is that I think there's pros and cons to both sides, right? I think in the first instance, you probably get grounded with a lot of really good technical and tactical understanding of the sport or the game that you're working in. But it's also very rigid because you've got these competencies, like you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now, it's a lot more open, it's a lot more free around what coaching could or should look like. But maybe there's less of a base or a foundation to work from. So I guess it further highlights the importance of maybe having mentors. But then the challenge that is posed for coaches coming through, and I'm assuming this will probably be the case in most sports now, is knowing what you need to go and find out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And knowing where to go to find out, because I guess one of the biggest challenges, well, Steve's been doing it for 24 years. He must know what he's doing. I'm going to go and ask Steve. But actually, what happens if Steve has been doing it for 24 years, but he's been doing it really badly?
Yeah, potentially.
That's it. It takes me to the question I always ask. I've been asking coaches now. It's like, how do you know it's working?
Yeah.
And I
did try and avoid it before, not on purpose, but I will come back to it. But you're right what you're saying. I think for me, though, like just listening to you talk there, coach developing is, it's just coaching, mate, isn't it? It goes back to like we discussed at the start of the podcast. It's connecting with people. It's being curious as a developer. And I learn quite quick. It's not about me just pushing my knowledge onto you or my methodology onto you. It doesn't work. It's about getting you to look at things through a different lens. And that's why I loved your podcast with Russell the other week. It's a case of, yeah, but have you thought about doing it that way? Or why have you done it that way? Can you just explain why that's happened? But not in a judgment way, but literally a curious way. And that's the way I work with my players. Like, what did you see? What was it in that moment that made you hit that ball down the line? And my players now that I'm asking that question because I'm literally curious. I've got an interest. I'm not trying to catch you out. And that's why I said before, as an educator, you feel like I'm trying to catch you out. Yeah. But as a developer, if I watch you coach football tonight, oh, yes, why did you set that practice up? Like, what was the intention? What did you see that made you go that way? And then you may say it and I go, oh, you know what? I didn't see that. Or I might go, oh, I love that, but have you thought about this way? And you go, oh, I love that idea.
Yeah. And
like, that's the way I work with coaches within the group that I work with now. And it's so empowering because there's no judgment. And for me, the question that you sort of came to there was, well, is it a resource thing in terms of good coach developers? Is it a time, finances? And I think that's why a lot of these governing bodies still have a traditional coach education system, because it is time pressure and finance pressure. But for now, like, I'm learning loads from just having a chat with you here. And I think it's just having those, I think it goes back to one of your original questions. What is coaching? Like, is coaching giving instruction and knowledge, or is coaching getting you to look at something in a completely different way? And I had a good debate with a school teacher once, and I said, I'm quite comfortable. I could go in and deliver any school session as a coach. They're like, no, you need all the knowledge about physics stuff. I said, I don't. I just need to know what the intention is.
Yes.
And then I think I've got the coaching skills to teach a physics session. I know nothing about physics.
Yes.
But I don't need to know everything. I just need to know how to get you, like you're saying, to get you to bring your attention to what's important. So I don't know, if I go and teach fencing tonight, I know I've got to get you with the saber. Okay, so can I think of a practice that gets you towards that? I don't need any experience. I'll probably get stabbed quite a few times with a saber trying it out, but it goes back to
But that's jiu-jitsu. Part of it, though, isn't it? That's part of the experience itself. It's learning what works for you, what doesn't work for you. And I think, you know, you talk about the constraints that, I guess, governing bodies may be under, but then it's a conversation I'm constantly having with coaches around, well, you know, these are the challenges that governing bodies may face in providing you an education in this sport or in this space. it just further highlights the importance of actually you being able to be proactive as a coach, yeah. being intentional and deliberate as a coach to go out and learn more. And it shouldn't feel like a tick box exercise to go and attend this EPD event or engage with this or engage with that. It's about developing yourself. And, you know, one of the, it takes me back to an event. I think I ran a CPD event in December last year, and we had about 25 coaches that I'd registered. Maybe half of them showed up, and I remember asking them, because they were asking me, like, you know, where can we go and get more information and whatnot. And I just thought, oh, this is a great question to ask you this time, because I was just curious. Where's everyone traveled from for tonight? You know, where's everyone travel from? Because some, you know, one guy said, to be honest, I live around the corner. All right, fair enough. Who doesn't live around the corner? Someone said, yeah, I live about an hour and 20 minutes, but it's taken me about an hour and 20 minutes to get here. So, okay, so you got an hour and 20 minutes and you got an hour and 20 minutes back. The session only lasted 90 minutes. So was it worthwhile? And he goes, yeah, no, it was really good. I really enjoyed it. And he goes, just next time, can you make sure the event's on a Wednesday again? I said, oh, that's interesting, actually. Why'd you say that? Because that's the fact that I'm not coaching. I said, oh, interesting. I said, just want to throw it out there. Would it not make sense? Like, just logically, it's not a judgment. What would happen if for one session, you just said, tonight, guys, we're cancelling the session. And if the parents ask you why, you say, because I'm going to go develop myself so I can come back and be a better developer for the players. Like, what would happen if coaches had that mentality? Because right now, and this is one of the dangers that we've got with the amount of information that's out there and how easily accessible information is that it's so accessible we almost don't take advantage of accessing it. And we want to make it convenient to the point where we're not willing to take an opportunity to go and attend an event or go and engage with a bunch of coaches or go and do some sort of thing that's going to help us actually make the sessions better. So I left them with the question just to think about. I said, would it be more beneficial if for the next 10 weeks your players got something that wasn't quite working? Yeah. Or would it be worth it if you just suck off one session and say, do you know what, I'm going to come back and the next 9 weeks is going to be even more impactful? There's no right or wrong. It's just a dilemma and something for coaches to think about. But coming back to something you said before I forget, it's that curiosity piece in terms of engaging with the coach or the player in some cases around setting that environment, letting them know, I'm not trying to catch you out. I genuinely just want to know why you did what you did or what you're thinking. Because actually, and the line I often preface it with is, I try and set the environment as best as I can. I say, look, I'm going to ask you loads of questions, and they're not to catch you up, but it's more important for you to understand that the reason for my questions is basically to identify where I can add value to you.
Yeah. It's huge, and there's just so much good stuff in there, because I think sometimes coaches do have that fear of coach educators developers of it's interesting, like when I do a CPD workshop and I say to coaches, who wants to show what they came up with? No one steps forward. I'm like, guys and girls, you're all professional coaches, you do this every single day. But there's a fear of stepping forward and someone going, no, that's wrong, no, what are you doing that for? That's stupid, that. So everyone holds back, and then I'm like, but there's no right or wrong answer. You only know what you know, you and you coach the best of your ability. And there's not enough curious coaches out there who are willing to go out their comfort zone. But then I say to coaches, but then you can't ask players to be uncomfortable. Because if you're not willing to be uncomfortable, you can't ask your players to be uncomfortable. And it's,
where do you think that comes from, though?
I think a lot of it is, to be honest, ego.
And like, I think it's fear.
I think it's fear. I think it might be ego, but for me, it's like I'm really vulnerable as a coach. But I do that on design. Like, I put stuff out there online. I do a bit like you. I do presentations and stuff. And that's not to show, oh, my God, look how good I am. It's me putting stuff out there because I want someone to challenge me and go, have you thought about this? Or that doesn't sound right. But that's me being really, really vulnerable. And I don't think people like being vulnerable in that regards as coaches. Because, again, goes back to the expectation. If you're a coach, surely you're meant to know everything. Whereas you may say to me, I want to work on this, and I go, I've no clue how to make that better. But that's
part
let's find out.
Coaches,
yeah,
part of the bottom of the coach and the coach developer. Like, you know, I said, and I have this debate with coaches all the time. And I say, like, I've got a mate of mine who recently just got into coach development, and he's like, you know, I'm not sure about this. I'm not sure where to start. I said, just start with what you know.
Yeah.
And be open about that. Like, for me, And I say it in jest, and it's a bit of a joke, but I say, but if you've got to know how you want to use your coach developer, but you've also got to know what your coach developer offers. Like, if someone comes to, like, if you came to me and said, like, yes, I really need help with my, I don't know, my healthy eating. Right, me too. When you find the answer, let me know. I'm not the guy for that. Right. You've got to know what you can bring to the table. And I think there's a power in actually just accepting, you know, I don't know everything. But I do know what I do know.
Yeah.
And I think that it's got to be the same for coaches. Like, you know, and I think it's challenged sometimes. Because like yourself, you know, you gave an example earlier. You know, you've got people that are coming up to you asking for private lessons. And you could do that 5 days a week. It'll be easy money for you. But, you know, I've had similar situations. Now, I actually turn people away because it's like, one, I'm not really passionate about what you're trying to get out of me. And two, I'm not the person for you. Like, yes, I could, you know, in theory, I could probably take your money and just go away and, you know, do something with it. But I'm not helping you.
Mm-hmm.
You're better off getting someone who's actually dedicated and passionate about the support that you're trying to get, and someone who probably knows more about what they're doing. And obviously, as coaches, we'll probably have a general idea of all the things that we might need to think about and consider, especially as we get more experience. But we're not specialists in everything. And I think, if you are, then probably a specialist in nothing.
And that's a huge point, isn't it? And I think, like, for me, that's what makes my job so great. Like, if I had all the answers, my job would be boring. Like, yes, tonight I've no idea what's gonna face me tonight. I've got a rough idea what groups I've got. I've no idea how those little players or humans are going to interact. And that's what makes my job so good. And it, like, I say this to coaches all the time. It's again, it's not what you know. Again, you do need some basis of sort of knowledge and experience, more importantly. But half the fun is that exploring part with the players. And it drives parents mad at times when I say, like, I got that wrong tonight. And they go, what do you mean you got it wrong? It looked like a good session. I didn't quite get the behavior I wanted from the players. I'm really sorry. I apologize. And they go, what? I go, but no, because I need to be vulnerable. So if you have a bad lesson with me, it's okay.
Yeah.
And like I did a session this week on Monday night with a girl. It's late at night. She's had a busy weekend, not getting the behavior. And I said, it's fine. It's okay. I'm not going to push you because you've got 20% in the tank and you're giving me 18.
But it's not, it's even just fine. That you make a couple of great points there. You just touched on that last one there. Like, her 100% effort tonight isn't the same as 100% effort tomorrow.
No.
Still 100% effort in her eyes and how she's applying herself, but she's at a different stage, different reasons. You know, she might have had a long night, she might have, you know, whatever it could have been, there might be other things going on, but it doesn't mean that the effort level has changed, but the output of the effort might look different. Absolutely. But then something that you touched on there, I think is a really important point to touch on, is that just how important it is for coaches to think about the education of the parents.
Oh,
and supporting the parents in understanding, actually, these are the processes that we're following, this is the methodology, this is the approach. And I think I say that because there is going to be coaches who have a perception of what coaching should look like. And there is going to be parents who maybe will agree that it should be the way that maybe you're doing it. But there's other coaches that will look at it and say, that's not coaching. But then it's up to you to help them understand why your approach is your approach and the benefits of that. But more importantly, before you can do that, you need to know what your approach actually is.
Yeah.
If you like, when that approach should be applied.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that bit's really important. So, you know, again, you got me thinking about so many different things. And this is one of the challenges for me sometimes. I leave these conversations thinking to myself, why did I have that conversation, man?
But it's good, though, isn't it? Because I think that's what separates people like myself and you to, yeah, 9 till 5, just in it for the money coach, because we're really curious. And we are constantly asking questions, not only of ourselves, but of others in that space. And I think the educational part with the parents is key, because their perception in tennis of coaching is very, like what I call 1970s coaching, of lots of technique and basket drilling and shouting and physical punishment if you get a ball, the ball goes out. And I'm like, that's not the best way to learn. And I have it quite a lot, because obviously I follow an ecological approach. Like, a lot of mine is a lot of questioning and problem setting, and it looks like a lot of chaos, my sessions, but then the game is chaotic, and parents can't get their head around that, because it's the opposite to how the guy on the court next to me is coaching, which I guess sometimes might be different in football, because in tennis, I might have six coaches all coaching one way, and then there's me. And you've got structured and regimented sort of environments, and then you've got my session, which is just chaotic and nuts. And that's where I've got to spend a lot of time with parents going, well, did you know, like, people generally learn through interaction and the relationship with a game? They don't learn through me telling you. Oh, that's really interesting. And I'll send them a podcast or a blog post and stuff. And that's quite tough. But a lot of coaches are scared of parents because they are the bank, right?
Exactly.
CEO. and parents get a bad rep. But for me, parents only ever want two things. One, for the kid to have fun and the kid to be safe. And 100%. if you tick those two boxes and you have a good relationship with the parent, you're on to a winner. The problem is coaches push the parents away, and then the parents get in the bear pit with the other parents.
Yeah,
and that's where the bad habits and stuff form.
And I think you're spot on. And one thing I say to coaches all the time, I don't think I've ever met an ill-intended parent.
No.
But I have met parents that are maybe ill-informed or miseducated. Yeah. Right. So part of the role of the coach is to help them understand the processes that you're following, because that's effectively what they're going to be observing when you're delivering to their kids. And if they understand the rationale behind it, they don't have to agree with it. But they can understand the process, and you know, you open their mind to accepting that. But something that you touched on there, and it reminded me, never actually answered the question: problem designer or problem provider? Then
I'm probably a problem designer. I definitely like to set my players' problems, and I think that's my role. But then I have to explain that to the parents as well.
Yes.
So, like, I'm not going to be telling Yaz how to play. Like, what? I'm not, because that's not my role. My role is to make him uncomfortable, put him in a position where he's got to work out himself, but I'm going to guide him. And that might be through practice design. It may be through questioning. I'm going to help him find the solution, but I'm not going to give him the answers. And the way I explain it to parents, like, it's like GCSEs. I can give you the answers and you may pass the exam, but when you come into the real world, you can't put it into context.
Mm.
Whereas if I educate you and you work out to solve the problem yourself, you can pass the exam yourself, but more importantly, you can put it into context.
100%, because you're aware of the variables that interact with your outcomes, right? And what's going to influence and impact on your performance as well.
Yeah. And I think I'll come back to the question that I've skirted twice that you've asked, sort of, how do I know it works? The truth of the matter is, mate, I don't.
Yeah. And this is the point I'm making.
Yeah, I honestly don't. And I think if you would have asked me that question 7 years ago, before I found ecological psychology, I went, oh yeah, I know it works. I've got good players. I've got national level players, and that's my benchmark of success. The problem is, for every one national level player I had, there's about 999 who weren't, who were all coached the same way. So if my method was so good, why did only one survive? And I'm like,
I'm so glad you said that, because it's literally the question I ask coaches. I said, okay, so your coaching really works, does it? How many players have you coached? And it's similar to what you said. You know, you're probably sitting about 500. Okay, brilliant. How many of those have been successful?
One.
I don't know. But they were just bad eggs. So.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's never your. It's never your fault.
It's never the coach's fault. It's always the player's mentality. Was now. Okay, how do I measure my success? If you're coming back in 2 years' time, mate, if you leave my sessions with a smile on your face, if you come next week full of ideas of what you want to try out, okay, I'm on the right track. I might not be successful, but I know I'm on the right track. Whereas 7 years ago, you probably leave my lesson in tears and frustrated and annoyed. And I think that's why I know I'm on the right track now.
It's a great way to look at it. Now, one thing I always say to myself is my role as a coach is, when I'm coaching in particular, and even as a coach developer, is to make myself redundant.
Yeah.
I want to get to a point with every single person I interact with is that you no longer feel like you need me, but you want me around.
It's I'm laughing because I got some stick recently from a parent and a coach, because like when I coach now, I'll set the problem because I'm a problem designer, but then I'll try and hide. I'll try and take them away from the environment that like I'm not on a tree or anything, but like in my center, we've got like fire exits next to the court. So I'll stand in the fire exit, and people think like I'm just taking myself away and I'm disengaged, but I'm trying to take myself, like you're saying, in a position where they don't feel I'm there and I'm having influence on the situation. I'm trying to almost put myself invisible, and then I'm watching how you interact. Because if I stand behind you and you're playing, you know I'm behind you. That's going to affect your behavior.
100%.
If you can see me in the corner of your eye, that affects you. So I try and hide. And people make fun of me all the time, and it's fine. And parents think I'm just disengaged. But then I say, no, this is what I'm doing. Because if I'm next to you, I affect everything. You get nervous, you get tight. So I'm trying to put myself in a position. And now when I think I need to come in, that's when I'll make my presence known. But I'm really conscious of when I intervene, what I say, how long that lasts for. Because I want to just jump in, give value, and then get back out as quick as possible. Yeah. Whereas 10 years ago, it would be a monologue of what is good and look at me. And so that's why I laughed, Ace, about taking yourself out. That's what I try and do. And you see it now with my players. They will play in training, and they don't even pay any attention to me because they're so used to me just being there as such. Yeah. But I am there, but I'm not there. And it really helps them. But parents can't get their head around it because the guy next to me is
my coach. It's an education piece, isn't it? Like, it's just helping parents understand why you're doing it. It's interesting you mentioned that, because it's literally just this morning I was having a conversation, just exploring some strategies and different ways to work and think about coach development. And I literally was saying to myself, I wonder what would happen if I just completely just stay away from the environment and just, but, you know, offer that sense of support. So it got me thinking, okay, how am I going to do that? I thought, I'm going to try this when I next engage with coaches and might be on a course, or if I go and observe a coach, just get a headpiece, earpiece, right? Just, right, here's yours, here's mine. I'm not going to be around you, but if you want to talk to me while the session's going on. And I think that key piece that you talk about, because you can do that with me there, but actually you probably feel more comfortable if I'm not next to you when you do it. So here's your earpiece. I might ask you a couple of questions here and there as you're going through it, but you don't have to respond. It's just something to consider. But if you want to talk to me, you can talk to me. And you know, it takes me on to another point. I've been challenging coaches on a lot recently. Okay, you're working with a coach developer, but how are you utilizing them?
Yeah.
What are you actually doing to get the maximum out of that coach development for yourself? Because if you're just viewing me as the educator, there's probably a lot of value being lost or untapped value that's not being, you know, being utilized here. So where, you know, what do you want from a coach? So I guess, you know, I'm conscious of time as well, but what would you say in terms of coach development, that, you know, from a coach's perspective, that they maybe need to consider in terms of how best to utilize the coach developer?
That's a great, powerful question. And I think for my work with, at this point, thousands of coaches, they see me as a resource of information. I've got all the answers. I've got the drills. If you've got a problem on the serve, I've got it. My first conversation is, I know nothing. Like, because what works for me won't work for you. So if you're working with a coach developer or a mentor, The first thing I'd say is you've got to be open for them to not critique, but to watch you coach. And you've got to be open for them to ask you questions. But more importantly, you've got to ask them questions. And for me, like, I did a mentoring group call today. And at the start of these group calls, I would have to lead everything and ask the questions and prompt and try and get stuff out now. But we're now in a process 8 months in where they're leading the questions and they're leading the discussions. And a bit like I said before, like coaching, when I coach develop, I'm a problem setter. So I'm looking at it different. But I think that mentality of, oh, I've got a mentor, but a mentor's going to give me all the answers. That's not how mentoring works. And I think for me, it's the reasons why. If you work with a coach developer just to drain all their knowledge, it won't work, because my success won't work for you, because it worked for me in that moment in time. And you've got to be just thinking about it. Okay, can you challenge me? And like, I've got mentors, and people go, why have you got mentors? Because you're a mentor. No, because I want people to watch me coach, and I'll feel myself coach. I'll send it to my mentor. And at first, I hated it at first, mate, because I felt like I was rubbish. Yeah. He'll go, why'd you say that? Why'd you do that? Is that really effective? And I hated it at the start. And then I thought, no, because that's good, because it's challenging my confirmation bias.
100%. It's a really good point. I mean, it's something, again, just coincidentally, in the last kind of maybe 6 or so months, I've been recording myself deliver coach education and do coach development. Yeah. And people ask me, well, why are you recording that? Well, like, the first thing is, can we get a copy of the session after you? I think they said for that.
Yeah.
About the session, this is about me. This is about my development. And I guess it's almost indirectly me trying to also explain to them, look, I'm still trying to develop as the coach developer. So you've got no excuse.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, it's interesting that I'm watching myself back, and not just watching myself back, but what am I saying? When am I saying things? What is the response and the reactions to the things I'm saying that I might have missed first take? Because, you know, I've got a question, and I was thinking about this morning, a question came up on an event that I ran back in November, and basically it was a free coach development CPD event. We had about 50 coaches show up, and one of the coaches asked me, has anyone got any questions as we're looking to finalize the event? He goes, yeah, why do you do this? I said, that's a really good question. And my response was, because I want to be the world's best coach developer. And it's literally that. So being out here doing stuff with you guys, whether I'm getting paid or not, is irrelevant. I'm doing it because I want to be better.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that was a positive or a negative thing for them to hear, but it's literally because I want to be better. So everything I do, and I often say to them, like, even when I'm having conversations with coaches, I say, like, if you pay attention to the way I actually speak, I'm not talking to you. I'm just speaking my thoughts out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And if that lands with you, happy days, everyone's a winner.
Yeah.
Because it's not about me trying to educate you, it's just about me getting my thoughts out loud. And then what I've realized, you know, it might be quote unquote my superpower in this space, is my thoughts often resonate with other people.
Yeah.
Or they challenge their thinking. And I say, well, listen, everyone's a winner now. I get to get these things out of my head that will never stop flowing, and you get to look into it and take it and do what you want with it. And it's, you know, it's a win-win situation. So there's a lot that is, again, you know, Steve, it's been a really fascinating conversation, and I'd love to potentially pick this up and have a part two, but I've got one question for you before we wrap up. 24 years coaching, probably a large part of that doing coach development as well, knowing what you know now, if you could go back to the start of your coaching journey, or if there's a coach listening to this early on, or at any point in their journey, really, what's the one thing that you wish you knew now that you didn't know back then that you think would have a transformational impact for you?
Mate, this could be a full-on hours podcast on its own. I think the one thing the advice I give myself is challenge everything. One of the biggest challenges, not my challenge is the wrong word, I believed in everything I was told at the start as gospel. So I was told of information processing and this is how you coach and stuff. And it wasn't until later on in coaching when I started going, is that the right way? And it wasn't until, again, I started looking outside of tennis and looking at football coaching, rugby coaching, and I was like, this might not be the right way to coach. I've spent 18 years doing it. And I think sometimes people will coach for two reasons. They'll coach how they were coached, or they'll just copy other coaches. And I think that was my biggest mistake. I just copied the coaches around me because I thought that's what good coaching is. And it wasn't until I started to look at other sports and other coaching, business coaching, I thought, it's not quite that, I don't think. And it's just, we mentioned the word to be curious. And I think sometimes as coaches, and I had this conversation at the end of every coach qualification, this certificate means nothing. You won't start coaching until you get on the grass in your case, or on the pitch.
Yeah.
But you've got to keep learning. You've got to do CPD. You've got to look out. You've got to be uncomfortable. And I think my biggest issue as a coach is I just stayed comfortable for too long.
That wasn't knowing you, though, was it?
Pardon?
It wasn't knowingly, was it?
No, not at all. I was just conforming and compliant.
That's one of the observations I've had with a lot of coaches now, and it's one of the challenges I see with coaches, especially in football. I can't comment on other sports because I'm not familiar with them, but in like, for instance, once you get to that UEFA B license, as an example in football, for a lot of coaches who are on that course, they're probably seen as a senior person in their environment, or the experience.
Yeah.
Now, the trade-off to something like that is because they're perceived to be that senior experienced individual in their environment, which might be the case, they're seen as the knower of all answers.
Yeah.
The whole person holds all the knowledge. Now, the challenge that comes with that is no one then challenges them.
Yeah.
And it is a trap I'm seeing a lot of coaches fall into, in that actually, fair enough, okay, people, you're challenging people, you're giving guidance and advice to people, which is great. But who's doing that for you?
Yeah.
And I think more so now than ever, where coach education, coach development shifted across, I think, all sports, I think it's become even more important now than ever to have a mentor or a series of mentors supporting you in different ways, mm-hmm. and being more deliberate and intentional in your behaviours and your actions around how you're going to develop yourself as a coach. So, yeah, there's a lot in there. Now, again, you got my mind thinking. I'm going to be mulling thoughts over on the school run now, not paying attention to the kids.
but mate, I know we're push for time, but that's such a key point, though, isn't it? And I think that's why I'm so vocal on social media. It's not to say this is the way to coach. It's okay. Can I get you to think of something different? And like you said before, I can put a piece of content out. You'll resonate with it and go, I love that. That's really good. Coach B might go, I'm kind of curious. I might look into that further. And Coach C might go, what a load of rubbish.
Yeah.
But that's fine, because as long as I've just opened some kind of door, whether or not you resonate with it or not, at least it's out there. And I just wish I had that early on my coaching journey, rather than, I say I wasted 18 years just following away, but I was successful to a degree. But now I feel that I coach. I've been a coach for 6 years.
I hear you, and I'm fully here for it. Steve, look, it's been a massive pleasure. I really appreciate it, man. Loads of thoughts going on in my head from minute one. Let's definitely get a session in for a part two, man. That would be worth it. But no, massive thank you to your time,
mate. Thanks for inviting me. I'm a big fan. I know we've only connected recently, but I love your blog posts. I think your podcast's great. And yeah, we'll definitely do a part two, because my mind's racing as well. All weekend, mate. I'm going to be making notes. But yeah, thanks again for having me on.
Awesome. Cheers for that, Steve. Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at The Coaches Network or on Twitter at The Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper. Distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.